is on.
Introducing Pretty Girls Love Real Estate. Stories of everyday women breaking barriers and building wealth through real estate.
Skinny Boss. B-O-S-S.
Hello, hello. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Pretty Girls Love Real Estate podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Washington, and I am super excited for another amazing guest today. I have Miss Gina Nesbeth. She is a dynamo in the community development finance industry. She was working for a number of years at Citibank, but now she's transitioned over to her own advisory firm called Knife & Clinton. So I'm really excited to talk to her all about what she's got going on. But first and foremost, Gina, how are you?
I'm well, Jessica. Thank you so much for inviting me to your show. I'm very proud of you, the work that you're doing. It's an honor to be invited as a guest.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to have somebody like you. So I'm really appreciative of everything that you're doing for, you know, women, for, you know, minorities in the industry. So really excited to have you and talk to you. All right. So first off, how did you get started in real estate?
So I like to say I'm actually not in real estate, but I'm in community development finance. And real estate is one of the large tools that we use to improve communities, because I only work in low-income communities across the United States. But I transitioned into community development finance probably a little bit later than most. I had a career as a in capital markets as a trader on Wall Street, and got to, you know, 40 something, and really started to sit back and assess, like, is this who I was supposed to be when I grew up? And it was through working with a coach that I started to focus more on not necessarily what I could do, but what I wanted to do. And I've always been passionate about making improvements in our community and sharing information that I might have for benefit of our communities. I've always been passionate about providing wealth and access to folks in our community. So this was a natural extension, and I had an opportunity while staying at Citibank to transition from being a trader to being a banker managing a tax credit business that allowed me to do just that, make investments in low-income communities, most of which are Black and Brown communities.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk all about that. But what I want to talk about is your career as a trader, because there's a lot of people that I've talked to that transition from Wall Street in various capacities, and now they do finance in the real estate capacity. So what are some of the, I guess, skills that make it so it's a lot of prevalency of people transferring over from trading or being on Wall Street in general to real estate?
I think there are both hard skills and soft skills that you either harness or develop, grow, working in banking, working in finance, working on Wall Street. And so some of the softer skills would be things like execution. It's got to get done. It's got to get done now. It's got to be done right the first time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you laugh, I see you smiling, but that's, you know, it's 100% or nothing. And so even if you think about the real estate process or getting a deal to a closing, how much intentionality, how much execution focused you need to be to get deals done. So that's some of it. In terms of the hard skills as a trader, while some might say, well, what does that have to do with doing economic development? Some of it is it's structured finance, and whether you're working with bond issuances or loans, you know, I did a highly structured, I actually traded a highly structured municipal based certificate traded in a short term market from a long term. But what I say that all to say is it's just boxes and arrows. You mm-hmm. follow the boxes and arrows. Starts out as a long 30-year bond, ends up as a short-term certificate traded in a short-term market. In between, there's a bunch of money movements mm-hmm. and documents created. And that's basically new markets tax credits. Same thing, right? You start at the top of the structure, you get down to the bottom of the structure, and money moves down and documents in between. So there are things like that. So deal closing, troubleshooting, working with money. You know, while I was a trader, My book was a $43 billion book. So working with large dollars amount, a bunch of zeros don't scare me. And also for me, what was really, what I liked about trading that I like about the work that I do now is there's opportunity for us to make transformational change with larger dollar amounts. So if you're not afraid of working with big money, with big dollars, and you know how to, you know, I want to build things. I want to change neighborhoods. I want to provide job opportunities for hundreds, thousands of people. And that's what this space allows me to do, that allows me to leverage my previous background.
Okay. I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball question, because you talked about not being afraid to deal with those large sums of money. And that's definitely like a psychological thing that a lot of people have to get over, especially when you're dealing with real estate, like the biggest deals. You know, you have a lot of different stakeholders involved, and it's not just, you know, financial you're worried about, but now you've got people's livelihoods on the line, talking about affordable housing, you're building shelter that's going to, you know, be important to people for generations. So just tell me about your kind of psychological, I guess, thoughts when you're dealing with such large sums of money.
Well, that's a great question. And I think it goes to sort of a fundamental thing that, particularly for Black women, we grapple with a lot, mm-hmm. is feelings of self-worth, believing that you belong, trusting in yourself and your ability to get things done. And I think, you know, success breeds success. So certainly there's been some, to the extent that I had some past experience getting things done, allowed me to feel like I could do more of it. But some of it is just jumping off the diving board and not sure if there's water at the bottom. And that's a scary thought. But, you know, again, you do it once, and if you do it successfully, or even, you know, I tell my daughter, either you win or you learn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's only one final day, and that's the final day. In between time, the sun's going to shine each and every next day. So, yes, we do want to protect our reputation. As you said, you're not just bringing yourself to the table, but there's so many other people involved, and there's accountability to that. So you do your homework, you do it the best you can, and then you got to trust in yourself.
Absolutely. And as you know, progress and you execute more, like you said, you gain more confidence. So
yeah.
All right.
Because also it's like, if not me, then who? And there's that. So I will also say, that it's important for you to, so, you know, I've been a lot of like full throttle, but it's also important for you to surround yourself with a team of people, mm-hmm. that you trust, that will support you, because, you know, I've closed, I don't know, 30, 40 deals. I don't know, but each one is a little different. And each time something's going to come up that I had not expected or that I didn't know about, I'm learning every single time. Everyone is nuanced. It's its own beast. So to the extent that you can leverage people who say, oh, well, I've seen that before, let me help you with that. And that comes into, that does take time to build a team that you trust and that can support you. But that's definitely an important part of the equation.
Absolutely. It's definitely a team sport. All right. So can you tell us just a high level overview? What are new market tax credits and how do they kind of filter into everything you're doing with community development finance?
We could be here for the next week talking about
that. Right. I know it's super convoluted, but I feel like you're the person that could give us a simplified answer on this.
I'm gonna give you the 10,000 square foot up answer. New Markets is a federal tax credit program that allows us to invest in real estate and operating business transactions in low-income communities that provide both financial, social impact in those communities. So it is a tool in the toolkit. If you have a project, whether it be, again, trying to build a building, or grow a business significantly, like move to a different area or take on a new product line, hire staff. New Markets can be that gap financing that can allow a project to pencil that otherwise might not pencil.
Okay. And is there a set, a number of credits that are available, like per state? How does that work?
There, it's not per state. So New Markets is a little different from LIHTC. For those folks who are familiar with LIHTC, it's, you know, with LIHTC, you have a project, you have a building with a certain amount of units, you've got a certain amount of eligible basis, you calculate what that eligible basis is, and then you go to the state. If they have credits available, you request those credits and you get awarded those credits to close a deal. That's for affordable housing, for sort of the everything but affordable housing. And there are some nuances to that too. So every now and a third blue moon, we can see a little bit of, we can see some affordable housing in these deals, but for the most part, this is for commercial development. And so, or operating business transactions. And so with that, what you do is you identify what your overall project costs are. Mm-hmm. Well, first you ascertain that the project is located in a low income qualifying census tract. That's job one.
Right.
The business needs to be located there. The building needs to be located there. The work that you're doing, the revenue generated needs to come from that area. And then you identify, you know, figure out what the total project costs are for what you're trying to do. And then what you do is you go out and you try to source three things. One is the allocation, the New Markets Tax Credit allocation, which I like to refer to as the funny money because it's not real dollars. But it's the juice that makes the real dollars flow. Mm-hmm. So you need, if you had, let's say, a $10 million deal, you need $10 million of New Markets Tax Credit allocation that will be used for benefit of the project. Then you also need the real money. And the real money comes in two different buckets. You get a portion of the capital stack has to be, will be New Market Tax Credit equity investment. Mm-hmm. And that typically will come from a bank. We now have insurance companies coming into the market, but for the most part, that's been bank financing. And then you've also got to have this debt component. We call that the leverage loan in New Markets, mm-hmm. but the debt component can come from any place, any number of sources. It can be hard debt that you get from a bank as well, or that debt could be soft forms of financing, things like grant monies, capital campaign. Let's say you're a nonprofit and you're looking to build out a community center and you've done a major campaign and you've got a lot of money, but you don't have all the money you need to build out this facility. So you've got that portion in that leverage loan that can be used for a leverage loan source in the New Markets deal. So just to recap, you're going to need the New Markets Tax Credit allocation. That allocation, I'll tell you about the allocation in just half a second. So you got to have the allocation, you got to have New Markets Tax Credit equity, and you need the leverage loan debt. Mm-hmm. In terms of sourcing the allocation, that is a popularity contest. It's a beauty contest for that allocation. It is a scarce resource. Every year, a branch of Treasury called the CDFI Fund awards this allocation out to qualified entities called CDEs or community development entities. They apply for it. It's very competitive. They win the allocation. They own the allocation. The project sponsor will then go out and pitch their project to these various entities that were awarded allocation to try to get, in this case, we're looking for $10 million to try to get $10 million for our project. And we market the project to these CDEs with a bunch of background information for them to make a decision. But a lot of the analysis, is typical underwriting, right? Like, does the project pencil and does the deal team look credible? Is the project ready? Is it in a state of readiness? But a lot of the analysis is also around the economic and community benefit that the project is going to provide to the low-income community. Right. So we want to know, is the project going to create jobs for local folks? Is it going to improve health outcomes, educational outcomes, any number of things? It's a very, very flexible financing tool, which is fantastic. It can be used to build pretty much anything other than a handful of sin businesses that the New Markets industry has identified. Mm-hmm. So it is very flexible, but each project will come to the folks who have this allocation when they source it and say, here are all the fantastic things that my project is anticipated to create for the local neighbors.
Got it. And what are some examples of organizations that are CDEs that we would know?
CDEs can be large financial institutions like the banks themselves. They may provide the equity to these projects and the debt, but they also apply for the allocation. So a large money bank centers are allocatees, receive the allocation, all the way down to small nonprofits. Mm-hmm. So it's a mixed bag. If anybody were looking to find who has allocation, you can go to the CDFI Fund's website. I think it's cdfi.gov. And there, every year when they award the allocation, they post publicly who the awardees were and how much allocation they received. So you can sort that in state order, mm-hmm. And find out who received allocation in your state. Because the other thing about this allocation is when it's awarded, the people who apply based on a certain strategy. And so if you have a project that's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you want, before you approach a CDE, you want to make sure that your project aligns with their particular strategy. And sometimes that strategy is geographically based. I'm only doing projects in Milwaukee, or it can be industry based. I'm only doing healthcare projects or charter schools or mm-hmm. And sometimes it may be broader. It may be I'm looking to address the racial wealth gap in the United States, or that type of a thing, or provide or address food insecurity. Right. So, you know, every CDE has its own strategy. And so that you can identify it that way.
Gotcha. So when you were working with Citibank, were they a CDE?
Yes. So at Citibank, I was an investor. We had a lending arm, so we could be the leverage lender. Mm-hmm. And I had headed the CDE for the bank as well.
So just give us an example of maybe one or two projects that you worked on there that kind of stood out to you.
I love the way that you asked the question, because a lot of times people will ask me, what's your favorite project? And that's like asking me, what's my favorite child?
Right.
And there's no such thing, right? But some of the projects that stood out to me, well, first, let me say, one of the things that I'm super proud of is I was very intentional with that allocation. So because, and we're going to get to this, I know, further on, but when you're writing the check, when you're the person who makes a decision as to what deals get done, I certainly had a whole bunch of layers within the firm itself that, you know, Gina Nesbitt alone was not making decisions on which deals we finance. I had a credit committee, I had bosses, I had to get everything approved through compliance, but I got to decide which deals I was going to bring to credit committee. Mm-hmm. And it was an honor that I was able to focus on minority led projects to the best of my ability.
Right.
So I was very intentional about it. Women-led, minority-led projects were going to definitely get a look from me. Ultimately, my portfolio was 34% minority or women-led. But some of the projects that fit in there that I am think about all the time. The last project I did was the Debbie Allen Dance Academy in Los Angeles.
Nice.
That was just an amazing project. One of the things that was important to her was that we have an all Black team, or at least an all minority team.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I know we're going to talk a little bit about sort of racial equity in our industry, but it was really revealing to think, if we wanted to have an all Black team, could we? And we could not. We mm-hmm. could not gather an all Black team. So, you know, but there was a lot of intentionality. So, you know, the architect, the lawyers, the accountants, the consultants, the appraisal company, you know, you think about all the various companies and roles and jobs and opportunities that there are in these deals. But anyway, Debbie Allen was looking to move into a larger building. She had been gifted a building by Shonda Rhimes, and so then she wanted to renovate the building for a larger location for her school, for the school. And in my mind, I'm a dancer, Jessica. I was supposed to be a dancer. I was, never been formally trained, but you know, in my mind, I am a dancer. So that just hit all the bells and whistles. My daughter actually danced for Dance Theater of Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
So to see those little girls and boys, you know, And that's the other thing about that's great about the work that I am fortunate to do in new markets is it's not just writing checks or closing deals or underwriting or doing the servicing of a deal. It's actually getting to see the real live thing come to fruition. And, you know, that's the best part of the work for me is getting to go and see what it did, how it actually, what was created. But so that was one. I also did a phenomenal project also in Los Angeles, MLK Hospital. So on the south side of LA, this project was lingering around for a long time. It's a county hospital. MLK Hospital itself was born out of the social unrest of the 1960s mm-hmm. and the rebellion in Watts. And as a part of that, they filmed a commission back in the 60s and said, what was the community lacking? What were the causes? What were the root causes of this unrest? And one of the things was there was not a locally based medical facility. So people were experiencing particularly trauma and having to go, you know, cross town or wherever to be treated because it wasn't a medical facility locally based. And so that's what they built MLK Hospital, but then it became a huge albatross. It was over the years. It was just, and ultimately the hospital itself had to close because you can Google MLK Hospital and see there was a national story where a woman was in the waiting room, the emergency room, and died in the waiting room in a wheelchair, keeled over, and people were just stepping over her. And so that closed the facility, but immediately the community was like, okay, yes, it was horrible, but we still need a hospital. hospital. And so it took a while for the county and all the stakeholders to figure out how that could be re-envisioned with modern healthcare and the like. And so anyway, we came in and built out the OBGYN facility for them and put in an MRI machine. Things that, again, were just transformational in that community. I won't go too long-winded with this, but talk about the cultural sensitivity. The hospital shell had been rebuilt, but it was built based off of a national model. And what was not accounted for was the community itself, highly Latino and Latina. And so, you know, just culturally speaking, one, the family sizes are a little bit bigger. They have more children. Mm-hmm. And two, the families, when mom gives birth, the families come and stay. And what the facility or what the hospital knew was that actually aids in that person's well-being, in right. them getting ready to be discharged. It aids in that process. So it's helpful to the hospital and to the healthcare system to have the family be able to stay. But if you've got a teeny tiny room mm-hmm. and you've got a roommate, there's nowhere for the family to stay. So they needed to reconfigure the rooms in the maternity ward to allow for pull out couches for beds and things like that so the family could stay. So that was another project. Schomburg up in Harlem, that was just transformation. You know, you don't have to say much for me to start like my projects, but you know, Schomburg, it's the Center for Black Culture and Research in Harlem. It's got the largest collection of Black art and Black artifacts and manuscripts. It's got James Baldwin's original papers, Maya Angelou's original papers. Like, you know, where do we begin and end? So projects like that, like those.
Right. And you definitely hit it on the head. Like, it's great. You know, you have such a like tangible impact on all of these things that are going to transcend, you know, past Gina Nesbitt, past Citibank, past whoever. Like, they're going to really like permeate through generations. And that kind of brings me to my next point, what we're going to talk about with the industry of community development finance, is that there are a lot of, you know, up and coming developers of color that want to build projects in their communities because they have that kind of link to those neighborhoods. But then you said the person at the top, like writing the check, they're the ones that, you know, ultimately decide which projects go through and which don't. And if you don't have that kind of connection or those nuanced different interactions with the community and whatnot, you might not know some of these things that are needed. So mm-hmm. I guess that brings me to the next point about you starting Open Access, which is this amazing fellowship program to get more minorities, women, people of color in general in those positions to make those decisions when it comes to those things. So tell me about what was kind of the genesis in your mind for wanting to start Open Access.
Yeah, thank you. So when I was a trader, you know, it was a lonely existence, right? I mean, I loved a number of things about the work, but certainly it was going to work every day in an environment where nobody looked like me.
Right.
But I wasn't particularly surprised by that. I mean, I'm, you know, working on Wall Street. I didn't expect to see a lot of people who look like me. But what I actually was able to do back then was, you know, you see somebody in the elevator or you see somebody in the bathroom and you're like, hey girl, where do you work? And where do you work? Right. And so we collectively, I would meet one woman, another woman of color, another Black woman. And we formed a group called CW2, City Women 2, because mm-hmm. we were city women also. That we would just, it was a group of maybe 20 some women that we found each other on all the floors and all the spaces in the bathroom, in the cafeteria, of professional women at the bank. And we supported each other for years. And we would have cocktail functions. We'd have functions over each other's homes. And we would celebrate successes. We would be there when there was failure. People got let go. We kept, or people left for other reasons. We kept them in the network. Mm-hmm. It was very in affirming. It was enriching. It was nourishing. One of our members, this woman, Micheline, I recall, always used to say, so we would get together and she would say, this was the first time I took a deep breath this whole day. Mm-hmm. And it's just that kind of, you know, was impactful. And so, you know, hence years later, I moved into community development finance. I start to go to the conferences and realize who else was in the industry. And it was definitely more diverse than trading was. But considering the industry we're in and the spaces where we were, it was just surprising to me still how few of us were in the industry. And particularly, as you said, how many of us are actually moving the money?
Yep.
Making the money decisions. So that had been something that had been on my mind. There's a gentleman, Jeff Monghay, who was a consultant in the industry, has been in the industry also, you know, a number of years. And he and I are friends. We've collaborated on a number of things. We've worked together. We would just keep having these conversations with each other. Like, what is up? How do we? And so one year we were at a conference, at a cocktail party, and we sat down at a table on a cocktail napkin and noodled out, like, what could we do to form some sort of a formal program that would provide opportunities for people to come into our industry? Mm-hmm. And what was important to me particularly was to pivot mid-career, because that's what I did, right? I was 43 years old when I woke up and said, oh, this is really not who I was supposed to be when I grew up. So that was like, we want, and the other thing that was important for us was I had been in corporate America 30 years. I certainly have seen any number of diversity efforts of special targeted programs to bring people of color into our various spaces. And what we always do is we start with college students or the high school students, mm-hmm. the entry level. Yeah. Now, I believe we absolutely need to continue to work at the entry level. But I also believe, I know that what happens to those entry level people is we can bring those folks in, but then somewhere mid-tier, mid-career, they wind up leaving, and they leave because there's nobody somewhere upstairs who can say, let me tell you what you don't know. Yep. Let me introduce you to this person over here mm-hmm. that you need to know. I know they said this, but what they meant was that.
Yep.
So there's nobody, right? Yep. yeah. There's nobody to pull your coat. There's mm-hmm. nobody to say, in the room, when you're not in the room, we need to make sure that Jessica's on that next project. Mm-hmm. I've seen what she does. She's fantastic, right? That's what we needed. So Jeff and I then decided we want to figure out how to create a program that would allow people to come into our industry, whether it's early, mid, or late career. And so that's what Open Access does. We noodled out this idea on a cocktail napkin. We included three pillars to the program. The first is training around the boxes and the arrows. What do they mean? What are the acronyms? How does the money flow? But then there was also I'm kind of blending here my two, but one was the formal training, was like just the classroom training. Right. And the other is putting bodies in seats. So we wanted people to actually work in organizations for some period of time where they could sit side by side, whether it be asset managers or underwriting, business development, consultants, lawyers, accountants, anywhere that they had interest in the industry, that they could work side by side and get some real live work experience. And then the third component was the mentoring and the networking. Mm-hmm. Jeff and I have been in this industry a long time. It's a small industry. We pretty much know, if we don't know, we know somebody who knows probably everybody in this industry. And so why not use what we've been able to call together over our careers for benefit of other people so that we change the place in some way, so that we leave it better than we found it. Mm-hmm. And I know you talked about developers who want to do this, that we provide access for those people to get those deals done. So that's really the intentionality around the program. We've got, how can we leverage what we've built for benefit of the next generation?
So you started Open Access in 2020, and I was honored and privileged to be part of the first class, the first fellowship class. So how would you say, you know, this is year three now. What are some of the, I guess, lessons learned from these 3 years, and where do you see the program going in the future?
Well, first, let me say how honored we were to have you join the program.
Thank you.
Because we can decide all we want on a cocktail napkin. But unless somebody says, oh, I think I might want to apply for that and go through the program and show up and do well, that's what it's all about. So thank you for trusting in us, your time and your talent to go through the program. We have learned a ton. So far, we, as you mentioned, we're on cohort 3. We've graduated 48 fellows. We've got 23 in this round. They will graduate in June. And of those that have already gone through the program, we have placed, I don't know, it's north of 60-some% in roles in our industry. And that, by the way, is accounting for the fact that there are some people who were never looking for a role in the industry. Rather, they wanted to start their own thing. They want to grow their own thing. They're a developer and they just want to learn how the tools work so that they could use it for their projects. Or they were happy where they were, but they just want to make sure that they've got more tools in their toolkit for their next step at some point in their career.
Right.
So it's just been phenomenally successful. We have evolved the program some. We have, one of the things that we did was this cohort is going to benefit from a formalized underwriting training. We've hired a professor at NYU to do 4 days of training. I think it's 3 hours a day of underwriting Excel training. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, very hard skill for people who are interested in it in the industry. We've also learned that, as you said, we noodled over this idea. We had the napkin. We were thinking about how to raise the money for it, how to launch the program. And then COVID hit and everybody quarantined and went home. And then George Floyd got murdered. So we had tabled the idea because of COVID. But when George Floyd got murdered, our friends and colleagues were calling and saying, Gina, how can we be helpful? Jeff, how can we be helpful in this moment? Mm-hmm. And so that's why we said, you know, even in quarantine, let's dust off the napkin and see what we can do. Because, you know, there was money being offered to do stuff. Right. And we had a solution, what we thought was a solution. So we launched this program in COVID and it was virtual. And so what we that afforded us the opportunity to do was we could have a fellowship provide. And so let me just back up a little bit in terms of how the structure works. We raised money to launch the program. But what we also needed were fellowship providers to sponsor our fellows. Mm-hmm. We needed people who were going to allow our fellows to sit in their organizations side by side to actually get the on-the-job training. And that is a financial commitment. But more than that, because our fellows are paid. Our fellows are paid an hourly, what you could pay them hourly or at the end of a project, however, but they are paid, you know, a stipend, a determined amount of money. So we needed fellowship providers to be willing to offer their time and their talent and open up their organizations. And it's accretive for both because our fellow gets to actually sit in the seat and get real job training. But also a number of the organizations who partner with us are looking at the opportunity of providing more people of color job opportunities in their organization. So several of them have hired our fellows or they may have hired the fellow that they had, or they may have hired another fellow. So, you know, it's a ecosystem that allows our fellows to benefit and these organizations to benefit as well. But so with the first cohort, those folks were allowed because everybody was virtual. We could have a fellow in Los Angeles working in an organization in New York City or Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. We now have more of a hybrid model as people are looking to kind of have more people in person. What we've also learned is that the financial sector, the banking sector, is still the hardest part of the market to impact.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been blessed by a financial sponsorship from the financial institutions, and we could not run this program without them. So that has been phenomenal. But because of all the these banks are regulated, they've got a lot more structuring to figure out how to have a fellow come into their organization and sit there for 3 months. Who's not a hired staff member, who's not an employee, who may not have licenses or the background check and mm-hmm. all of these various things. It's harder for, so that is, when we think about 2.0 for open access, that's one of the areas of our ecosystem that we still believe we've got some wood to chop to figure out how to be more effective in that space. But we've done phenomenally well with CDFIs and with CDEs, consulting firms, putting people in seats.
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of my fellow classmates, like you said, were hired at different organizations. And I've seen the people that have come, you know, after that. And, you know, everyone just has fantastic things to say about it. You hired an executive director.
Yes. Yes. We have our first executive director. So now Jeff and I can go back to doing our day jobs. And we are elated to have an executive director. And you mentioned that you know some of the other fellows, because I'm so heartened by, and I don't know if it's just this generation or if it's the COVID experience for folks, but we have encouraged our fellows from each cohort to stay connected to each other, and to the other cohorts. And in great measure, people have done that. And so this is, you know, it's not just networking our fellows within our industry or with our connects, but it's also the fellows networking within themselves. And I like to say, we were the mentors, but, and you all may have been the mentees while you were through that program, but we're going to be mentored as much by you as you've been mentored by us. So we look at it as like Jeff and I pick up a whole new network mm-hmm. That we want to stay in touch with as well. So it's been fantastic to see how the ecosystem has grown. I go to conferences now. I was at a conference just this week in Atlanta called Develop. Baker Tilly put on a conference for emerging developers in Atlanta. And, you know, I see some of my open access fellows at the, you know, so it's fantastic. Yeah, it's all good.
Absolutely. Yes, it's phenomenal. Can't wait to see all the progress you guys are making in the future. So now I want to talk about your new business, or it's, I feel like it's been over a year now. So 9th and Clinton, which you do advisory services within, you know, this community development finance industry. So tell me about why you started that, and what are the name 9th and Clinton? What's the inspiration behind that?
Yeah, so I'll start with the name because that kind of leads into what the business does. 9th and Clinton is named after the two streets that I grew up on as a child. Mm-hmm. 9th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and Clinton Avenue in Brooklyn, New York, both of which were low-income census tracts when I lived there. So the company itself is in great measure me taking everything that I've learned throughout my career and trying to make sure that it's a benefit for the people who come from places like where I come from or live in places where I live. Mm-hmm. So it is a strategic advisory firm. I do new markets consulting as a part of the business, but I also have other clients that are not new markets clients. They may be in affordable housing or they may be in social justice. I have CDFI clients who have brought me in to be on a long-term retainer to look at various parts of their organization and be intentional about the work so that they can be more intentional about the work that they're doing, bringing maybe a racial equity lens, sitting on their investment committees. I have a client, Basis Investment Group, an amazing woman, Tammy Jones, founded this company. She is an investment firm that invests all throughout the continuum in the real estate industry, real estate markets. And she is also the only Black woman to have a seller servicer license with Freddie Mac and now Fannie Mae. She just got the first license that Fannie Mae has given out, I think, in 12 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. And she wants to change that. She wants other people who look like her, minority-led firms, whether they be CDFIs or MDIs or other organizations, to be able to access these agencies in their lending book. And, you know, you think about what's happening now, what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and what's happening with rising interest rates. This is a perfect time for these institutions to be able to create some velocity in their lending book. So right now, a lot of our institutions, we make loans and we keep those loans on our books. And, you know, maybe those loans are highly concentrated, like SVB found.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe those loans could provide more fee income for the banking and for the financial institution if we underwrote the loan to a Fannie or Freddie takeout so that, you know, you underwrite the loan and then you can sell it to one of the agencies. Now you got the cash and you can go back out and make more loans. So this is, it's both an opportunity for other lending institutions to create fee income, but also to reduce risk, to work with bigger clients. You know, maybe the size of the loan is bigger than you can keep based on your own lending policy, but you can, if you underwrite the loan, you know, so this is an engagement that I have with Basis, and I'm out helping them to meet clients that they otherwise might not meet and form correspondent relationships so that they can be mentored by Basis organization. And then again, ultimately, wouldn't it be fantastic for them to get their own license? And Basis can help them in a mentoring relationship to do that too. So a wide range of clients that I have now, but all kind of trying to change business as usual and provide access and opportunity.
All right. So what's next for you overall with the business, with you personally, anything you want to talk about?
Jessica, I'm a Gemini, so we go anywhere with this conversation. And I got about 12 jobs because I just, you know, I'm writing a memoir. I don't know where in my journey it'll get published, but I am writing a memoir about my experience on Wall Street and how how pivots happen and how you take who you were as a child and it stays with you all through your life. Mm-hmm. It informs the decisions that you make, and how for people who show up differently, there's still space for you too, if that's what you want to do. So that's the memoir. I'm being mentored right now because I'm thinking about doing a podcast on women who move the money, mm-hmm. women of color who move the money. What else? The business is 1 year old. I started the business on April Fool's Day. I'm here for the joke. I have a lot of intentionality around how to create a sustainable business model. Mm-hmm. And, the first year I was very much a taker of deals that came to me, of client relationships that came to me. Mm-hmm. And so this year I'd like to kind of think more holistically about what the revenue model should look like and what do I want to do going mm-hmm. forward. Another thing that I'm doing that I am highly passionate about is I sit on a board of a group called EIFL, which is the Institute for Entrepreneurial Leadership. It's based out of New Jersey, but EIFL is at its core, it helps minority women-led business owners to grow their businesses. But what we have continued to grow out recently is how do we increase the ecosystem of angel investors, mm-hmm. particularly Black angel investors, because we know when you have startups and you're looking for friends and family capital or just that bucket of money after that, when you're pitching organizations, angel investors, seed investors for your company, we know it's very hard for Black women to source financing. Mm. We know that.
Right.
They get less than 2% of venture capital, of angel capital. But we also know that these investors tend to invest in companies and people who look like them.
Yep.
It's not a racist thing. It's not a sexist thing. It's a thing. We do. We naturally gravitate to people who look and feel like us. It's familiar. It's comfortable. We understand. Mm-hmm. And so we ourselves have an opportunity to invest in ourselves. Yep. And there are lots of us who are accredited investors who could be making angel investments in our companies. And we aren't doing it, one, because we don't know. Mm-hmm. Just information, just sharing that information is not available or not readily available. So EIFL is trying to address that need by doing boot camps, by offering webinars, by providing on-ramps both ways so that business owners know, entrepreneurs, startups know that there are funding opportunities outside of debt called equity, and you can source equity if you learn all these things, as well as for potential investors to know when you look at your portfolio. As I said, more of us are accredited investors than we realize. The basic requirement to be an accredited investor is $200,000 of income or $300,000 if you are married, or $1 million worth of assets. Now, the asset can't include your home, but it can include your 401k and other longer term investments. So for folks who are about my age, if you call together one of those two, there are a lot of us who do qualify but are not investing because either we view it as too risky on the continuum, or we don't know enough about it. So, or both. But we're trying to grow the ecosystem of Black angels. Because I will say it is risky, yes, but the upside is phenomenal.
Yeah, so, higher risk, higher reward potentially.
There you go. Yeah.
That's amazing. So
that's another thing I think is just if I could pitch anything, is if you don't know about angel investing, look it up or reach out to EIFL, EIFL.
Yeah, because we always talk about real estate on this show, but investing in businesses can have, infinite returns.
And by the way, developers are businesses, mm-hmm. are business owners, right? So, and I know a number of developers who are launching funds now We didn't talk about that, but one of the things that I did at Citi outside of running their new markets business was I managed their private equity portfolio, and we made equity investments pretty much to white guys on a regular basis until George Floyd got murdered. And we then decided we wanted to designate $200 million of private equity capital to find Black fund managers of affordable housing preservation. Mm-hmm. And so I awarded five Black fund managers $40 million of capital each, so that as opposed to raising capital on a deal-by-deal basis, you've got $40 million of capital, which was contemplated as a multi-investor fund. So those fund managers could go out and they could raise more capital on top of that. And now you can make wiser, more nimble business decisions about the properties you invest, you purchase, when you've got capital that you already know you have access to. Okay. So, you know, there's that, right? Like we don't think about it even in the real estate development space, but there's private equity capital there too.
Absolutely. And I would say, especially with people that I know in the tier or level of development, there's opportunity in that kind of middle ground area. Because, you know, Citibanks of the world, the large institutional funds, they want to put big dollars. They're not going to write a check for $1 million or something for individual development. So I would say there's the opportunity in the middle space for, I would say, in between, let's say, $5 and $20 million for equity. Because that would be higher than what an individual investor would want to put into one deal. So
something else
to consider for us. Anyway, let me shift to the last segment because we can talk all day as we usually do. But I want to go to the last segment of the show, which is called The Fabulous Four. It's four questions I ask every guest. So I'll start with the first one, which is, what is your favorite book about real estate?
Color of Law.
Okay.
The Color of Law, because it is a seminal read.
Mm-hmm.
And when you understand how land was stolen,
mm-hmm.
was denied, was undervalued
intentionally,
it wakes you up in the morning. It will wake you up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I know that's a bit of a classic, but I think if anybody has not read that's 101.
For sure. Okay. The second question is, what advice would you give to your younger self just getting started in your career?
I think the thing that I learned the most, you know, like I said, I came from, you know, first generation in a lot of ways. I had a lot to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I learned that was the hardest for me to learn was the value of networking.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it, but I shied away from it because it was so foreign to me and it was so uncomfortable to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people tell me now, like, oh, you're such a networker. I'm like, you have no idea how hard that was for me. But I also think the thing that I learned late is life comes in chapters. And we always think, you know, Michelle Obama wrote about that in her book when she said, people ask, what do you want to be when you grow up? As if you're only going to be one thing when you grow up. You got to figure out now what you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not a thing. So I think to the extent that we realize nothing is fatal but death itself. And so, you know, it's a chapter. These are chapters in your life. So that I would leave it there.
Right. And it's your life. So you can reinvent yourself or foray into different projects or careers, paths, whatever, as many times as you want.
Yes, you can.
Okay. Third question is, what topic within real estate do you personally want to learn more about?
I am a daily student. The more I learn, the more I know what I don't know. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'm trying to learn more about is a couple things. The other tax credits, because
mm-hmm.
I was a new markets person. I've touched LIHTC, I've touched historics and stuff, but I would not say that I'm, you know, an expert on those other tax credits. I sit on a treasury advisory committee for racial equity. which is charged with trying to be in, make sure that we are mindful and watchful around all of the the Inflation Reduction Act money that the Biden administration has recently approved and Congress has recently approved. So there is a ton of money that is going to be hitting the street in the next couple of years around green, sustainable energy. Mm-hmm. And the real estate, how the real estate market fits into that. And I'm trying to be more educated on those things.
Yep, it's good to know. So, you know, you can funnel the money to projects that we want to have develop. Absolutely.
We got to realize how important, how not just important, how directly impacted we are mm-hmm. within the environmental crisis.
Mm.
Because we're downhill of all the stuff. Our neighborhoods are downhill of all the stuff, all the bad stuff that's being created uphill.
Yeah.
So we are impacted by it. You know, you look at the Flint water. I mean, you could just go across this country, stormwater runoff systems across Jackson, just you name it. There's things that we're being negatively impacted by more than any other population in this country that, like you said, we should now be able to take advantage of the money that is being appropriated to improve those situations.
Absolutely. All right. So last one, not really a question, but can you give a shout out to another woman in real estate?
So back to the Gemini, I can't think of just one. There are so many. So I want to list two who are just industry stalwarts that everybody should know their name. I mentioned one, Tammy K. Jones with Basis, just killing the game always. She'll tell you she grew up in a housing project in the Bronx, and she now owns this multi-billion-dollar real estate investment firm. And she is intentional. She also is the leader of REESE, the Real Estate Executive Council. Mm-hmm. She's just intentional and here for it every day. A woman who I call my aunt, whether she knows it or not, is Gwen Hatton Butler. She has been in the industry just knocking down doors. She is just a badass in every way. She was with Capri Investments, but she has also been very intentional with, she's a big name in Chicago, been very involved in Chicago real estate. She's from Detroit. She reps Detroit. and she is a senior, she's just been a senior leader in NASP, the National Association of Securities Professionals, as well as REESE. And just a mentor to me. Can I name my youngins, my come up?
Sure.
Okay. So I got someone to come up. Julia Stevenson, mm-hmm. who is both a mentee and a mentor. She's a director at Landon Park Capital out of D.C., but Julia's been around. She was at LISC before that. She's doing a bunch of stuff. Alicia Hill, VP at Impact Investing at FCP. Mm-hmm. Alicia, I love her story. She'll always tell the story that she's done a trillion different jobs, like the most random jobs ever, but they all led her to where she is now as an investor looking to invest in affordable housing developments across the country. Shannon Herbert, that's the last name I'll mention. Shannon Herbert, Executive Vice President at Inclusive Capital and Vice Chair at Rochelle Capital. She is a credit officer at her core, underwriter at her core. But she has formed an organization. She's one of the people who's formed an organization that's looking at changing the underwriting box for how we underwrite deals that have historically kept Black developers out of getting their deals approved or financed. How do we create a culturally sensitive lens to the underwriting box?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, those are just the names that I came up with, and I could come up with like 20 more if you gave me more time.
Oh, that's a dream team. Like phenomenal, phenomenal ladies doing a lot. So how can people get in touch with you if they want to talk to you more about, you know, whatever, all the million things that you have going on.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. I am very active on LinkedIn. My company is 9th and Clinton. And so the website is www.9thclinton.com. But you can reach me via the website or via LinkedIn is the easiest way to hit me.
All right. Thank you so much, Gina. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing in the industry and just for mentoring people like me and other young ladies within the real estate industry and just, you know, just being an awesome person in general. Is there any last words of wisdom that you want to give to the listeners?
Last word of wisdom. I will say, it's not wisdom, but I'm proud of this generation. I'm proud of who's up next. And I'm proud of you, Jessica. So just keep killing the game. And you mentioned it, but you know, you got every day to decide who you want to be. But we need you. We need every one of us at the table working on the problem. So, you know, I'm happy to be a part of the solution, but I can only be one person and there's no benefit in one if there's not two, three, four, and five behind.
Amen to that. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. This was amazing. And I'm looking forward to all the things that you have going on and looking forward to, you know, seeing more fellows coming out of Open Access and just, you know, kind of changing the trajectory of the industry. So appreciate you. All right.
Well, this
was another episode of the Pretty Girls Love Real Estate podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Washington. Thank you to my guest, Ms. Gina Nesbeth, and we will check you on the next one. Thank you.